Hello, welcome to this podcast from Rooster Punk and Shake Marketing. I'm Gemma Huckle, Head of Content at Rooster Punk. Today I'm joined by my lovely boss and co-founder of the agency, James Chisona, to talk about humanising B2B companies, together with Dr. Simon Kelly and Stacey Danheiser, principals of Shake Marketing Group and co-authors of the books Valueology and Standout Marketing. Hello everyone, thanks for joining me today.
Hi there.
Hi there.
Hello.
I thought I'd just start with a quick intro of everybody. Should we start with you, James, for our listeners who aren't familiar with you?
Sure. So Paul and I started Rooster Punk back in 2012. My background was technology. Then when I realised tech brands were terrible at articulating what they were about and did and who widely would care, I moved into marketing. And I certainly think that's a theme which came out strongly in the guy's book.
And Stacey, could you just give us a little bit about your background and what you're interested in?
Yes, absolutely. So Stacey Danheiser, I spent half of my corporate career in B2C marketing and the other half in B2B marketing, working mostly for Fortune 500 companies. I worked equally in strategy and execution. So I've seen marketing from a bunch of different angles. Now I'm the founder of Shake Marketing Group based in the U.S., where we work with B2B organizations to help with customer insights, value proposition development, and marketing strategy. And I'm also launching a new community for professional marketers called SOAR Marketing Society, which is aimed at elevating the B2B marketing profession and helping the marketers earn and keep a seat at the leadership table. So excited to be here and talk about this today.
Hey, and Simon, how about you? And I guess, how did you come to meet Stacey? Well.
Yeah, I've got a long career in customer service and sales originally, and then 30 plus years in marketing, almost exclusively in B2B, but sometimes working in companies that do both B2B and B2C, which can be challenging. Using a Rooster Punk type model, I think I actually rescued one part of the company at BT from the pit of despair in a world where it was trying to sell 1,000 products one at a time. And move them towards a much more customer value, storytelling type theme approach to marketing and selling products, which I also tried to do when I moved to level three in North America, where I was running North American field marketing, working with Stacey. Now I call myself a pracademic. I've worked at several universities. I'm now at the University of York, and then working with Stacey, I help companies develop standout value propositions and marketing strategies. I mean, I'm interested in more interesting stuff like James, like rugby and hiking and baseball even. But I've got a long time professional interest in customer value propositions and differentiation, and in particular in helping marketing and sales work together effectively.
Thanks. I love that term for academic. I love the, you know, kind of the fact that you've got, you know, that logic and that kind of background, but also that practical, implementable kind of perspective on things. So let's move on to the books. You both recently launched your new book, Standout Marketing, in which, you know, we've seen a lot of crossovers with our book, Humanising B2B. This is why we kind of invited you to the podcast. It'd be really great to hear a bit more about the book and the research behind it.
Thank you, Gemma. The book's called Standout Marketing. The subtitle is How to Differentiate Your Organisation in the Sea of Sameness, which is fairly important. We began with more than just a hunch based on the research we'd done for our first book, Valueology, and added that to our experience of working for and with companies. And marketing and sales leaders were definitely telling us that differentiating on customer value is difficult, so we wanted to find out more. So what we did in the first instance, we scraped the websites and Twitter feeds for the top 30 companies in three different sectors: telecoms, because that's our heartland, if you like, data centers, because that's the sort of booming type of industry, and then UK higher education, I think, because we thought it might be entertaining. And we found, not surprisingly, I think, for us marketeers, that all organizations were saying the same things, using the same generic words, talking about themselves way too much, making bold claims about being able to transform organizations without actually linking back to any particular clear understanding of a problem or clear path forward to a solution. And that's leaving the customers swimming in this sea of sameness, which makes very difficult for customers to make choices. And this is why, you know, 58% of deals in business to business end in no deal, because the biggest competitor ends up being inertia, because it's all too difficult. So we wanted to find out more. And because it's our preference, because we like the narrative like you guys, we did depth qualitative interviews for lots of business leaders around the world, and a global survey, because it's nice to have the statistics to back it up. And we found that the problem is a human competence problem. You know, in that it's okay saying the stuff we said in Valueology and saying the stuff that you guys are saying in your humanizing B2B, but in the end, it involves human beings, and the human beings have to have the competence to be able to do the things that you're asking to do. Yeah. So you would never ask somebody like a prop forward in rugby to sort of dribble down the wing for 50 yards, because they're just not built to do that, and they would never have the competence, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, you know, the sea of sameness is a phrase that kind of really rung true with us, because Rooster Punk often talks about the problem of marketers talking way too much about speeds and feeds. Mm-hmm. So I guess we were quite interested to hear a bit more about what marketers can do to create standout marketing, and, you know, what your opinions on that, Stacey.
Yes. So it is a sort of interesting problem, as Simon mentioned, that, you know, we found that really it kind of resides with the competency gap. We asked the question, why does this happen? Why is sea of sameness happening? And we found that there were several different reasons. One is that, you know, companies that, let's say you're working in a commoditized industry, and where companies are having success, they have that comfort blanket of success. They don't want to change because they've had success and that's how they got to where they are. There's also this risk aversion to try something new and to do something different. I mean, that's really scary, to be bold and courageous, especially in a well-established industry. We also found that there's inexperienced executives and inexperienced marketers. They just, you know, it's easier and safer to, you know, what we call follow the herd, and going to look at somebody else's website and kind of copy and paste what they're doing is seen as really the safe route. And then we'll get into this subject a little bit later, but this inward looking team, that really this focus of speculating what customers want and not really having real data or insights there, but just a bunch of opinions kind of talking around the table. But most telling, we thought, you know, of these reasons that people are kind of stuck in the sea of sameness is just laziness. So that was interesting when we talked with a lot of leaders, and we said, why is this happening? And they said, it's just lazy. It's, you know, marketers have a tough job. They have a lot of work to do, and it's just easier, you know, in some regards, to just take what your competitors are doing and copy it. So that's kind of why it's happening. And then, you know, as Simon mentioned, this is a competency gap. So we found that, you know, there's a lot of books written about skills on how to be a better marketer. And this is, you know, what you need to do, tools and frameworks, and how to be a better copywriter, for example, or how to, you know, do SEO, or how to do content marketing. Those are kind of all on the skills side. On the competency side, it's more about how you're doing your job. So applying those skills and that knowledge into your day-to-day role to be successful. And we narrowed this down to five competencies that spell the acronym VALUE, because we believe at the heart, a marketer's job is to create value, not only for the customer, but the organization, their community, shareholders, and really just kind of a reminder that those function exists to create value. So the first is visionary, V for visionary. This is about seeing the big picture, understanding what's happening, not only in your industry, but the industries in which your customers are operating in, so that you can predict and imagine and strategize about what's next. The second is A, activator. A good activator is what we call a balanced advocate. So this is being able to understand, you know, not only what's good for your customer, but then how does that connect to what's good for the company? So somebody that can see both of those. And then it also requires, you know, activator. This is one where most marketers will say, oh, that one's, I'm really good at that one, because that's execution and I'm really good at doing the tactical execution. But it's also, you know, a really good activator requires great listening and negotiation skills, because they have to get buy-in to, you know, programs, whether it's introducing a new product or launching into a new vertical sector or implementing a marketing campaign. And that that requires a very specific skill set to be able to kind of stabilize, you know, and mobilize the troops, so to speak, to all march in the same direction. The next one is L, learner. And, you know, 2020 perfectly summed up why learning is important. So we started the year off with one set of plans and then, you know, 6 weeks into the year had to quickly adjust. Some companies rushed out and immediately started talking to their customers to learn what they were thinking so that they could more effectively position their products or answer their concerns differently. And other companies just sat back and waited, you know, and waited to see what was happening. And again, we kind of ended up in the sea of sameness there too, because we had a lot of copying going on. So, you know, learning is one of those competencies that marketers have to make time for. So that's reading books, it's listening to podcasts like this one, not just about their craft and how to do marketing better, but about their customers' world too. So interestingly here, we heard from many leaders that while they have budgets to support their marketing team going to seminars and events and training, it's rarely tapped into. And so this is, you know, this is one that's marketers can't lose sight of that sense of curiosity, and then having the discipline to continue to learn and grow so that they become, you know, continue to be relevant, not only in their jobs, but to their customers. Which leads us to the next one, usefulness, you. And this one really aligns with your golden triangle framework, which I know you guys are going to talk about here shortly. But being useful is all about understanding who your customers are, what they care about, so that you can connect the dots as to how you help, and then cut out everything else that's irrelevant. If they're not interested in all the details and all the features, you know, then we don't need to stuff all of our marketing content and sales pitches with that information. So, you know, at the core of being useful is all about understanding your customers. You can't be useful if you don't first know what they would find valuable and useful. And then lastly is E, evaluator. So this is being able to thoughtfully and honestly evaluate your marketing programs, what's working, what's not, and really understanding how that is adding value back into the organization. So one of the key themes we hear over and over from marketers is, you know, I'm really frustrated. Nobody understands marketing. I have to prove the value of marketing. So this is really the skill set of evaluating data and then connecting that back to why, you know, an organization would care about that. So this requires a little bit of political savviness, especially if you're recommending, let's say, to kill a pet project or a great idea from the CEO or the leadership team. So I know that was a lot, but that's our value framework, kind of the five competencies that we found are critical for standout marketing.
That's the whole book right there.
I know. Summed it up.
It rings so many bells, because I think you're so right in that there's some great specific books out there on skills, specific skills, but competencies are something bigger. And for us, we really wanted to take a kind of philosophy view at the whole of B2B marketing. We love it. I've been in B2B for most of my career. And yeah, always in agencies where I had B2C and B2B, often you kind of get looked down on. You don't have the budgets, you don't have the tools. And yet I was there as an ex-tech guy, having worked for these big B2B firms, going, yeah, but B2B is changing the world. These are the firms which are making the world work. These are the businesses that matter. And actually, looking forward, these are the businesses that, as they put purpose and people more at the heart of what they do, and we can help them do that, they're going to change the world in a positive way, in ways actually consumer brands probably a little bit behind the curve and in an inward-facing way. And I think, you know, you mentioned, you know, 2020, great year for learning. Yes, absolutely. But also, I love the quote you had from Heraclitus in the book, which is that great one, the only constant is change. And it is. It is absolutely, whether you call it inertia or laziness, you know, marketeers, we always have so much going on, but we always have to learn and remind ourselves why we got into marketing, which is generally not because it's the best way of making yourself a millionaire. It's supposed to be enjoyable. It's certainly not the best way to make a millionaire, right? it's supposed to be creating stuff. And there's so much risk aversion and fear built into the industry. We need to break through that. And that's the meteor. That's coming. That is the sea which people are drowning in. And that's what we, you know, that was really struck a chord for me, was that desire to lift and help us all be the best versions of ourselves. Because this is an industry which, not just because we care about the industry, we care about the industry's potential to do amazing things.
Yeah, and, you know, kind of just like you said, James, the phrase "the meteor is coming," which is what your book starts with, it strikes a chord with Stacey and Simon's, because it's all about kind of, it's a wake up call, isn't it, to stop all of this copycat marketing and create some real standout. And you know, it's whether it's due to laziness or budget cuts or safeness, staying in that safe zone, it's a real wake up call. It's interesting to note that the premise of both books really is like down to just humanizing marketing, like you say, and Stacey touched upon the golden triangle framework that you guys have created. It's a really lovely visual, which we're all familiar with, but maybe you could explain for our listeners a bit more about the framework as a tool and how it's actually meant to kind of help B2B marketers change their language so they talk to customers and they're more relevant.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, I mean, the golden triangle, as we put it forward in the book, is it starts with, as Stacey said, at the heart of things, yes, understanding the customer is really, really important. And frankly, not everyone's brilliant at doing that, but we all kind of know we should be doing that, you know, being customer obsessed, being customer centric. Although I love the idea of balanced advocacy that the guys talk about in the book, in that you shouldn't be obsessed just by the customer. But firstly, for the triangle, you start at the base level, which is knowing what you're selling. And that's kind of in the early noughties. Frankly, a lot of tech companies were able to do that because the tech itself was interesting. They were selling to a lot of techie people with really innovative stuff. And a lot of the time it was differentiated through the what. But actually now, whether it's SaaS, whether it's just how tech has moved on, the type of buyers have evolved. So you've actually got to understand the buyer far more, and not only her conscious needs, but also her unconscious needs. And that's where you start to get out of the comfort zone of a lot of marketeers, where they're just, you know, looking at what people say they want, not so much understanding what they really need. And coming back to some of Stacey's book, you know, it's about understanding the decision-making unit is much more that shift away from the salesperson engaging early on. Now, so much more of that remit is with the marketeer. And so the marketeer's got to understand who they're selling to in both conscious and subconscious or unconscious ways. But then at the end of the day, the top of the pyramid is how to sell. And again, one of the risks we have in our meteor is, you know, sales are great at selling and marketeers have to find the ability to sell. Because at the end of the day, if you're not selling, what's the point? Now, how to sell? It's the language of emotion. And great salespeople have always known this. It's about connecting. And increasingly, we've seen more and more research, again, helped by the pandemic. It's about empathy. And another great quote from the guy's book is, most people listen with the intent of replying, whereas you should listen with the intent of understanding. I love that, because it really gets to the heart of what we're talking about humanizing B2B, is about finding empathy with your audience, whether it be the sales team. Yeah, because you can only be a great activator if you've got the executive team, the sales team, the product team, everyone aligned. And actually, that's what allows you, not just in your role in terms of a marketeer, but in life. If you become great at mastering the language of emotion and understanding how to influence and persuade people, that's just the most amazing life skill. So that's at the apex there.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's not just about the customers though, is it? It's also about, you know, kind of starting on the inside with your employees. So be a bit more interested to hear about the five principles of humanizing B2B that kind of tie back into, you know, starting with your company culture. Can you just run us through those principles, James?
Yeah, and to what you just said, I mean, again, the guys in their book talk about going from customer-centric to people-centric. So our first principle is about, it's about people, not product. Yes, the product has a place, but we are people selling to people. The second is about, it's about actionable purpose. It's about having a purpose, but one which actually flows through the organization and is actioned in everything you do. You can't just be sitting on a PDF on some server somewhere. Third one is, you have to have emotion at the core. Yeah, and that's really what that purpose, driving that purpose. But you've got to remember that emotion drives all decisions. Again, that myth that actually we are rational animals, which makes our minds up purely on rational criteria, has been thoroughly debunked. So great, emotion at the core. And one of those core emotions is likability. The fourth principle is actually likability can be transformational. actually, and likability can manifest itself in very different ways. And it's really about, again, seeing the customer, the audience, seeing his or herself in you. And that can, and that forces you to choose about who you are. So you come back to archetypes, forces you to, like any good marketeer, recognize that you're not for everyone. That's what the fourth principle plays to. And the last one is, how do you do all this? Well, we founded as a storytelling agency back in 2012, before it became a sort of thing everyone's talking about. But storytelling is absolutely the vehicle by which you're able to land emotionally. There's all the great neuroscience that we as human beings, we are primed for story. Our brains light up when we recognize we've been told a story. That's why you end up watching those awful movies, which you probably watched before in the middle of the night when you're flicking channels, because you want to know the end of the story. And you're much more likely to remember it, and you're much more likely to empathize with the characters in it if it's told through the vehicle of story. So those are our five principles.
Yeah, and out of all of those principles, Simon, are there any that strike a particular chord with you?
I'm glad you used the word chord, because I mean, what I didn't admit to earlier, I absolutely love music, particularly rock music. In my spare time, I'm now a DJ on a community radio station. And so it's not just about the single chord, it's about the whole of the, if you like, melody, which is what all those five things bring together. But, you know, like every great song, you've got to be grabbed by the opening riff. And my greatest song ever is Brown Sugar, because it's got the best opening riff ever in a rock song, yeah? And so the opening riff in your five is people, not products. You know, now I think there's lots of research out there that says only a very small percentage of customers buy because of a product difference. And this is coming from people like Forrester, who James well knows, are really a technical or an IT consultancy practice. So if their research is telling you that, and has done for a good number of years, then that tells you something. But, you know, lots of companies don't buy on that difference, the technical difference, but still, as we know, companies keep communicating through that kind of difference. My speed or feed is faster than yours. Even though there's a massive history of products not winning because of the best technical spec, you know, the old VCR players are the prime example of that. Well, at the customer interface, as James alluded to, salespeople can make the difference by delving for deeper understanding about issues. And you actually answered my question better than I could, James, by reminding me that if you can listen with a view to understanding rather than to replying, then that's a nugget that provides differentiation. And the reason is because if as soon as you hear the customer talk about something that gives you a product hook, you jump straight away. But if you wait and ask more questions, you get much more insightful understanding about the thing that's really causing the anxiety, the implication that's going to play out if the problem's not resolved. And so we need to be able to mirror that in our marketing efforts. You know, so your example about the trinkets and how you sell the trinkets differently by adding a story to it, I think is really powerful. But I remember way back in my old days at BT, where one customer we were serving moved from being served by the guys who looked after medium-sized business, and it came to us and we looked after global business, and we'd gone through this transformation of doing this sort of customer-centric stuff. And the customer said, this was a big oil company, saying, those other guys weren't talking to me like that. And it was all about different conversations, different levels of understanding. So I think it is people, but we do know that companies don't buy on relationship anymore. There's lots of corporate executive board research that proves that. That the buy on relationship, if the relationship is insightful and people are bringing new things to the party and offering new insights and, you know, drawing out problems the customer didn't think he had, as you guys point out in your great book. So finally, I mean, like we said, people internally have to be able to do all this. They have to be competent to do it. And that is at the heart of the problem. You're not going to beat Manchester United by having a lot of average players. You might beat my team, Rotherham United, but that's not going to get you anywhere quickly, is it?
When companies are ready to reply and, you know, kind of speak the language of emotion and customer and product, how can organisations begin to start articulating their usefulness. I think that kind of ties back into likability. But how do they kind of really show how useful they are and prove their value and kind of position themselves so they sound unique?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's this point of understanding and digging for deeper understanding, which gets you to that place. And when you dig down, it's often emotional concerns. You know, COVID has highlighted this even more, as James said, and people are looking for organisations that can display more empathy, treat the human being as the whole human being. In IT and telecoms, just to be talking back in our heartland, the problem is that when you reflect back what you found when you're working with clients quite often, they're just either not brave enough to want to do the thing that you've unearthed. So you say, we've talked to a bunch of your customers and they're saying, I'm overwhelmed by this. This is really concerning. If I bought this thing and it doesn't work, I could get fired. You know, nobody got fired for buying IBM, as you said, James, and it's an enduring phrase. So getting to a point of a higher understanding about the emotional concerns and tying the emotional concerns, we think, to the rational concerns, I think you guys say, at different points of the buying cycle, which I think is a good way to look at it, grab them with emotion and then at the end justify with a rationality, maybe is the way to go. But, you know, trying to get your clients to be brave is where the challenge can be, and trying to get your company to be brave enough to say, stop saying all this crap about speeds and feeds. Try and move somewhere else in that sort of model of brands that you guys have. Be a bit different brand archetype as well, yeah?
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, we've always been saying about, you know, people don't buy from you, they buy into you. It sounds like, you know, B2B marketers really need to change their mindset. So what do you reckon they could do to kind of start, you know, changing the mindset of their teams? That's quite a big challenge that they're up against.
I mean, I think if you're leading the team, you've got to demonstrate that, you know, and you've got to demonstrate that you're applying some of the competencies that we talk about by demonstrating that there is a vision that you can move to, yeah, and a vision that's a different place and that's a world that your customers live in. Because we all live in those places as well. You know, and we would have anxiety if our organizations weren't performing well or our personal lives weren't being run well. So why wouldn't the customer, and why wouldn't you reflect that in the way that you talk to them, yeah? And so, you know, in that golden triangle that you talk about, there is that also important point of, yeah, here's the emotions, but talk about the business concerns, not the thing. So productivity, agility is also important, as well as the thing that's keeping them awake at night, or the more anxiety-led emotional thing, or the positivity you can tie to emotions.
It'd be interesting to hear from Stacey about kind of how that really links back into the kind of activation of the competencies that you were talking about earlier on in our conversation, and how, you know, marketers can start to convince the board to move to a more kind of brand-led approach.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a really interesting question, and kind of where we are today with the state of B2B marketing. So, you know, at the core, activation is about getting buy-in and getting everyone marching in the same direction. But there's some very real barriers that marketers are up against that we can't ignore. So there was a report that was published a few years ago in the Journal of Marketing, and it was found that there was a database of 65,000 board members that they looked at, and less than 3% of the board members had executive level marketing experience. So, you know, the question is, wow, you know, that's obviously not something that's valued. And then they did another study and they found that only 4% of those board members believe that marketing is an important experience to have on the board, versus 47% who said finance is. So, you know, that's kind of barrier number one, is that, you know, you can't convince a board or a C-level to invest in a customer-led or brand-led approach without first sort of understanding what their definition of marketing is. And then in a report that I read sort of about this, it was really fascinating. And this is some of the research. We actually have a whole chapter on this question: what is the role of sales versus what is the role of marketing? Because we find that just fundamentally, there's not agreement on who's doing what and what those jobs are. But if within this report, as it relates to the boards, there was, you know, a few things that came out. One is that most of them view that marketing as a tactical, not a strategic function of the business. That most, you know, they see it as fluffy or promotional or running promotions or advertisements and creative and communications, which, you know, as we know, there's four P's of marketing, and the promotion is one of those. But most marketers are not responsible for the product. They're not responsible for the pricing, and they're not responsible for the place, you know, distribution. So, you know, there you have it, that the viewpoint is, well, that's marketing's only responsible for communication, and therefore that's not really strategic to how we're going to make an impact on our business. The other thing that was interesting is that they said that, you know, looking at some of these brands, that there is an element of luck. So that, you know, it was not necessarily contrived, and that there was this big giant strategic plan to become dominating in the sector, but that there was a big element of luck. And there's books like Outliers and other things that kind of talk about this piece, right? There's a whole bunch of momentum that has to happen to kind of catapult somebody into that. So you look at these private equity firms and VCs that are trying to duplicate that, and that's really hard. So to change the perception, I think, you know, first, marketing has to just get out of focusing only on lead gen or tactical execution, and they really have to double down on being the voice of the customer, getting plugged into what the customer really wants, needs, and values, like we talked about. That is a skill set, frankly, that most marketers don't have, especially in B2B, because they're not allowed to talk to the customer. So when I worked in consumer marketing, it was unheard of that you would launch a campaign without doing focus groups and, you know, buying customer data and customer research. I mean, that was a big chunk of our budget that we would leverage to test these things first. Whereas in B2B, you know, it's perfectly acceptable that you would go waste, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars a month on advertising, not really knowing if the advertising was going to work or not because you didn't do any customer research. So, you know, going back to kind of the mindset and the mind shift, is that marketing does not just equal lead gen or tactical execution. So I think, you know, a further point, Simon and I worked with a client where it was, we did customer research on their behalf. We presented it back. And the head of marketing at the time was really excited because she said, because of that work, you know, I've now been invited to participate in strategic conversations at the organization. Previously, marketing was not invited. And now all of a sudden, because she was viewed internally as the voice of the customer and, hey, you're the only person sitting around the table that actually knows what our customers are thinking or wanting, you know, now all of a sudden that's the role that she's playing, and she's now invited to those conversations. So, you know, marketers, I guess, fundamentally need to just treat their C-suite and their board like a customer. You know, first understanding, what do they care about? What job are they there to do? And what motivates them personally? And then next is, then they can only then kind of, again, understanding what is it there that they want, can they then position how marketing can add value to that business? So for example, do they care about growth? Are they all about risk aversion? You know, and marketing needs to be able to present, going back to the top of your pyramid, you know, it's about now tying all of this together and telling a story to the board and to the C-suite that are in terms that they care about, and that, like, really basically sells the value of marketing to the organization.
Yes, Stacey, it's so true, because how often do we as marketeers sometimes fail to use our own skills in terms of storytelling in things like board meetings? We had a great example of this. So Crowdcube, who are a fantastic crowdfunding organization, great guys, but came to us very much talking about speeds and feeds. That's really, it was about the platform, the number of people that had on the platform in terms of investors. And we came back with this idea, this narrative around, well, actually, it's all about the entrepreneurs and their stories. And it's the wonderful things they're doing. It's not really the returns. Most people, on average, the average investment is £1,000. Now, actually, the truth is most of the average investment is really £100 or a big sum of money, but it comes out statistically at about £1,000. So all those people putting in £100, it's not so much about the return. It's about they love the concept of the thing they're backing. And so this idea came, funding the wonderful, these wonderful brands which are helping to change the world. Now, in truth, the guys at Crowdcube weren't too sure about this. So we did a bit of research, but also told the story by actually getting some of their customers, some CEOs and the founders of these businesses. And it was supposed to be a case study video. So we were talking about their company, but we sprung this question on them. Do you think it's wonderful what you're doing? Halfway through the interview. And they all stopped and paused and said, well, you know what? I don't think about it that much because I'm just doing the work and building the business. But when I take a step back, I do. I think it's what one of them said, my mom thinks it's wonderful. And I suppose I think it's wonderful. And it was suddenly this human truth that actually let's just celebrate the wonder of what these guys are doing. You know, these entrepreneurs, these CEOs, what she's creating. And that, as I say, initially with the guys at Crowdcube, we initially felt, it was that a bit soft, but we kind of combined customer research with the storytelling, the human visuals of these entrepreneurs being asked the questions about whether they thought it was wonderful, suddenly made it so much more powerful as a vehicle to get everyone behind it. And as you say in your book, you've got to get everyone in the organization behind it, from the executive, the founders, to the salespeople, even to the operational people, who is answering the phone, whoever is dealing with the customer complaints. I mean, I love that concept. And Paul and I were debating it earlier in the week when you said, if you boil it down to one word, what would that word be for marketing? Alignment. And we kind of had a healthy debate about this because shouldn't it be engagement or should it be something else? But actually, no, I think you're dead right. It is about making sure that there's an organizing story, a belief, which everyone is able to articulate. Everyone's able to get behind. Everyone's able to absolutely, in an active, useful, measurable, and visionary way, align behind that. And I thought that was so true.
Yeah. And just touching on vision, Simon, you talk about having the, this is all tying back into that competency conversation as well. Having a visionary competency, and that kind of ties back into value and why it's critical for sustainable competitive advantage. Can you kind of explain the impact that visionary leaders can have on business outcomes?
Oh, yeah, wow. I mean, most successful visionaries, really successful ones, we don't have a difficulty identifying. James talked about Elon Musk. If we had a sort of competition around the table now, we'd probably talk about Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos at Amazon, Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook. And maybe on the UK side, you'd talk about Branson or somebody who's more like a brand visionary. And we've seen great companies like Airbnb and Uber come from nowhere because people have had a vision about a new way to do things. But what we mean here, if you like, a more pragmatic level, although you could have a visionary idea that blows you out to be somebody that gigantically successful, is that marketeers and business leaders need to have the ability, the competence to look at the world in its broadest shape, like an eagle, fly 3,000 or 4,000 feet up and look at the broader landscape to see what's happening in your customer's world, in your own world, and then to have the ability to swoop down and say, that's the thing that's going to make us successful. And here I'm going to try it with a story, which I've not used for a few years, but I think it used to work in BT. If you've been to Southern Spain or Italy, you'll know that they have all those fantastic Parma hams, and they're hung up on the side of the bar and you get the Parma ham with your beer. And the grow pigs like that to provide those hams, and they're called super pigs. So what you're actually looking for in any environment is your own super pig, something that you can construct because there's enough demand there potentially for you to be able to grow the pig in a different way and then talk about the pig in a different way. If Paul was here, Paul's a business graduate, and he'll know that one of the tools you get taught at university is a thing called PESTEL, which is an environmental analysis tool, which encourages people to look at the broader landscape of what's out there. But what people are then not good at is sort of having foresight and then choosing and swooping in on the thing that could be successful because customers need it and it's good for your own company. And then if you join the two together, it's going to transform the way that things work in the customer's world and in your own world. So that's a tough competence to develop, but I think it's one that people can develop by looking for different perspectives, going on TED Talks calls, reading beyond just their own industry and their own practice, and looking at how technology is moving and trying to make some sense of how those things join together.
I love the talk about zooming, don't you? I love that because mentioned rugby. what we've found, so I'm involved with the local rugby club, and mental health has really been the core thing we've been talking about, actually pre-pandemic, but especially since. And a huge amount of that is around resilience, making, you know, we're not about creating elite sportsmen and women. We're about creating resilient, happy people, human beings. And perspective and the ability to step back and be able to provide perspective to your own life and your own challenges and then zoom back into the detail is actually a core part of mental health development and something we talk to the kids about. Because it's so easy to get absolutely stuck on the detail and the, you know, sometimes positives, but often negatives. We tend to, you know, fixate on the negatives. And if you can take a step back, it's so much easier to solve problems. And so it's not just a marketing skill. It's absolutely such a fundamentally powerful life skill to have.
Yeah, completely, yeah.
And just, you know, kind of like you were saying, going to TED Talks and keeping your finger on the pulse of what's going on in the world and kind of zooming in on that. How do leaders really kind of go and talk to their customers and pull out the values and the knowledge points, and how can they use that to drive vision and value for them? How do they kind of put that into practice, James?
Tough question. It is, going back to some of the earlier points, you know, it's about belief. It's about vision. I love the guys, you know, the value starts with vision. And so, yes, you've got to have a vision, great, but then activator. You've got to constantly reinforce. You've actually got to connect the dots. You've got to have all those conversations outside the meetings. You've got to build allies. You've got to build a momentum to get over that inertia we talked about before and coach people. You know, the art of coaching, especially when people are remote in the pandemic, when people are more anxious than ever, becomes more important. It comes back to that learning point. So you've got to, you know, create, spend all the energy, time and energy, the greatest leaders. And I love this new idea, well, not new, but idea that's gaining momentum of the servant leader, where she is absolutely not the testosterone presidential type guy at the front of the room shouting, follow me. It's the person who's creating an environment for success because she's making her team feel confident to be able to take risks, to be able to sometimes fail without fear of judgment, to create psychological security and safety. That allows you to innovate and gets you over the laziness or the fear of failure, all those things. And by giving them clear goals so they can understand how they are being useful as well as the brand is being useful, and clear ways to evaluate them. You know, so it does actually map quite nicely back to the value framework. You know, but think of it on a human level. You know, your vision isn't just about you telling people to do something or which hill to go up. You've got a commander's intent, fine, but you've got to enable them and empower them with the environment and the trust and empathy and the listening skills to go and do what they can do better. Because I love the fact in marketing these days, most of the people leading an organization probably have fewer skills in the actual doing the job than they used to. In the, you know, 80s, 90s, you tended to do, it was the same stuff, right? Whether it was letter setting, whether it was doing a TV ad. These days, because there's been so much change, you're now running a team typically who has skills you don't have because those paradigms weren't around. Those things, you know, doing location-based Instagram marketing didn't exist when you were learning the ropes. So you can't base your credibility on the fact that you know more than them. It's completely different. You've got to base your credibility on the fact that you're creating an environment for them to succeed in. And that, for me, is the only way, really, to lead great teams. And I think in the pandemic, we've seen that also. Countries that have done very well, don't want to get too political, are ones where, you know, they've not tried to make it all a war, make it all about, you know, overcoming and beating. It's all about communities and understanding, coming together with compassion and empathy.
Great. And finally, just one last question for everybody is kind of, do you have any simple advice for anyone listening who's trying to elevate their career in B2B marketing today? I guess we'll start with you, Stacey.
Yeah, all right. So I have a couple of things. And one is just on that point that James was talking about. I mean, we have talked a lot today about the need for customer understanding. You know, I would say if you want a game changer in your career, be the person in your business that understands your customers the best. And, you know, how do you do this if you're a marketer? The first is you have to understand the sales function. And, you know, I heard, and I worked in companies where it was mandated that, you know, marketing needs to go spend time with the salespeople. But without really understanding sales and the job that they're there to do, salespeople quickly got annoyed with that and stopped making time for marketing because they weren't finding any value in those interactions. So, you know, it's really understanding the sales team, the job that they're there to do. How does a salesperson make money? How do you make their life easier? This is really underrated, we find, in a lot of B2B marketing companies, because those organizations are so separate and so siloed. So, you know, first and foremost, it's marketing understanding sales. Go pick up a sales book. And there's numerous that talk about sales methodologies that just sort of so you can understand sort of the role that the salesperson has to play. And you'll identify opportunities for marketing to add value in there. But the second I would say is to budget for real customer research. So, you know, this should not really be a nice to have. It shouldn't be the thing at the very bottom of your budget that when your budgets get slashed, that's the first thing to go. It should really be the first thing that you're doing. And if you want, like I said, to be strategic and viewed as a leader in the organization, it's really coming with that customer understanding. And then the second, I would say, whether you're a leader or whether you're an individual, it's making time to develop yourself and your team. So, you know, one thing that we discovered through that competency framework is that nobody's going to come to you and tell you exactly what you need to focus on and where you need to grow. You have to take ownership of your own career. And we tried to make it easy. We have a bunch of assessments and exercises in the book after each chapter. So if one of those competencies, you know, stuck out and you want to learn more, you know, start there and start getting on the right path to develop yourself. But you really have to make time for it rather than putting it at the bottom of the priority list.
Great. And any tips, Simon?
To narrow it down to one, it's tough. I'd probably pick up on what James pulled out of the book. I do really think that alignment is what marketing's all about, and people need to understand that. So the best way you can continue to get alignment and improve is sure by starting with the customer. But I think in order to develop and succeed, you need to understand that it's about competence. I find it very strange in marketing compared with sales, and then it's very easy to compare it with lots of sports like we've talked about. You wouldn't try to be a great rugby player or a great football player or a great baseball player or a great dancer or whatever you aspire to be without understanding there are sets of competences. And it's not just about the skill piece. It's about all the things that James talked about the resilience, the ability to reflect, the sort of trying to develop, having a more visionary competence. So always look at yourself and your teams and say, okay, what is it that we need to be to be better marketeers, more competent and more able to align our organizations and what it is we do with the thing that is important for the customer and for the business at the same time.
Great. And James, do you have anything else to add?
I think the one thing I would pull out, which is because, you know, we were founded as a storytelling agency, it's something we probably lean into more than the guys, is storytelling. And it's certainly something which we have found, as you say, it can be considered as a marketing tool, but it shouldn't. It should be considered as a life tool. The ability to tell powerful stories. And actually, you know what? It starts with yourself. It starts with, to Stacey's point, your self-development, your narrative of who you are and where you want to be, and creating a narrative for the people around you, which is something which is positive, empowering and true. Start there. Understand your own story. Understand what you're great at. You know, don't be hard on yourself and don't look at just the negatives and what things you need to learn to be. Find the positive stories in the same way you would, you know, with your own brand. You know, and actually be great at telling that story and understanding how that story will evolve. And then work with your team, understand their stories, your organization, you know, the department, the vision. Be a great storyteller and recognize that, you know, narrative drives everything, drives happiness, drives our sense of accomplishment. And actually, so if you become good at storytelling, which starts, you know, and there are simple tools for it. Obviously, in the book, we've got a number, but it really starts with, you know, understanding the context. Then conflict. What are you trying to do? Who's the heroes? What are you trying to achieve? And then how it resolves. And stories are that simple. It's a simple construct. And if you become good at articulating it, as I said, even just to yourself, starting with yourself, you know, starting understanding that the first audience you need to persuade is yourself and have the confidence to get out there and speak, especially pandemic. Something we're looking at a lot is that how do people act differently in hybrid working environments? How are they able to succeed? The quieter people, the people who may be more studious, the people more reflective when they're maybe more remote. Less so the case in America. America's had remote working for longer, I'd say, but in the UK, you've certainly seen that challenge. But starting with understanding your own story and your ability to articulate stories really well is, I'd say, the one piece of advice I'd leave people with.
Okay, I think that's a wrap, guys. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. Simon and Stacey's book, Standout Marketing, is out now and available via shakemktg.com. Humanising B2B is by James Chazona and Paul Cash and is out now, available via humanising, that's with a Z, b2b.com.